From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM, and happy Veterans Day to all of you who have served or are serving in our armed forces. Thank you so much for what you do. Later tonight, a special tribute to all of you with our friend Danyon Brinkley. Here's what's happening. The United States has hit another record of coronavirus hospitalizations and surpassed 1 million new confirmed cases in just the first 10 days of November amid a nationwide surge of infections that shows no signs of slowing down. The new wave appears bigger and more widespread than the surges that happened in the spring and summer and threatens to be the worst. But experts say there are also reasons to think the nation is better able to deal with the virus this time than last time. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has updated its guidance on coronavirus-related face masks to include protection for the wearer as well. The masks with multiple cloth layers are more effective, they say, in blocking tiny, potentially virus-laden particles from passing through and exposing the wearer to the infection as well. Early results from trials of a COVID vaccine developed in Russia suggest it could be 92% effective. The data is based on 20 cases of COVID-19 from 16,000 volunteers given what they call the Sputnik V vaccine, or a dummy injection as well. Some volunteers who took part in Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine trials say they were left feeling like they had a severe hangover. More than 43,500 people in six countries took part in the phase three trials by the pharmaceutical giant. They were never told whether they were injected with the vaccine or a placebo in the double-blind tests. But some say that they believe they had the drug because of severe headaches, fever, and muscle aches that were compared to getting the flu shot or recovering from a night out, a heavy night out. Howard Bloom's checking in on this for us. What do you think, Howard? Doesn't look like there's any end in sight for this thing.
No. One of the 13 advisors on Joe Biden's COVID transition team, Dr. Michael Osterholm, says we are, quote, about to enter COVID hell. And you get a good idea of what he's talking about, but there's more. The coronavirus is getting wildly out of control. As of tonight, we Americans have hit a towering new number of coronavirus cases in a single day, 144,270, and there are still 2 hours left counting in California. For comparison, the number of new cases that seemed shocking in June was less than 20,000. Today's figure is more than seven times as high, and COVID cases are skyrocketing in the most unexpected places. Rural counties, previously untouched by COVID, counties whose citizens do not believe in shutdowns, face masks, and social distancing. Counties in the wide open spaces of Montana, the Dakotas, Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, and Wisconsin. Even worse is the appalling number of hospitalizations and deaths. Yesterday, for the first time since the COVID crisis began, hospitalizations in a single day shot above 65,000. This means that hospital staffs are overburdened and exhausted. By the time you or I come down with the coronavirus, there may not be a bed for you or a staff to care for you. Then there are deaths, which have moved from less than 450 a day 10 days ago to more than three times that yesterday. Fortunately, there is hope. You referred to some of it. Pfizer has put out a press release, that's all there's been so far, announcing that its new coronavirus vaccine is a stunning 90% effective. That compares with 40 to 60% effectiveness for the flu vaccine that our doctors urge us to get every year. But the Pfizer vaccine has a problem. It has to be stored at minus 103 degrees, which is far colder than the refrigerator in any standard lab or doctor's office, which means that we would need an entirely new national refrigeration infrastructure to get this vaccine to you and me. Fortunately, there are 10 other vaccines in late stages, but Dr. Anthony Fauci hints that you and I are unlikely to be able to get a COVID vaccination until June. Now, at the rate we're going, that means roughly a quarter of a million more of us will have died. That's 10 times the number of deaths per year of the common flu. But there's another kind of cavalry that come to the rescue. It's a $5 test you can administer at home. These are tests you can keep two dozen of on your kitchen counter, and use whenever you want. They're tests that can tell you when you might infect others and should isolate. One of those tests already exists. It's the Abbott Binax Now COVID-19 AG card, and others are in the final stages of development. But regulators do not want to allow these tests out of your doctor's office and into your kitchen. Now, all this came home to me, George, when I was on Coast to Coast with you last Wednesday night. I'd had chills for 2 hours before I went on.
Oh, boy.
When I got off the air, I went to sleep and didn't wake up again until 7 o'clock the next night. Now, thanks to the privilege of telemedicine, I was able to consult a doctor on my laptop 2 days later when I'd finally regained my ability to speak in coherent sentences. And the teledoc gave me a simple checklist of symptoms to watch out for. Symptoms like low blood oxygenation and high heart rate, which fortunately my two $35 smartwatches measure. But without a simple home test sitting on my kitchen counter, there was no way my teledoc could know if the virus he diagnosed was COVID, and no way to know if I could be spreading COVID to others. So when it comes to sane COVID management, we are almost there, but not quite.
All right, Howard, thank you. And of course, folks, you've got a decision to make. Thanksgiving right around the corner. Do you invite a lot of people who aren't direct family? Do you know what they've been into? Who knows? But it's going to be a tough season, to be sure. Stocks jumping on Wednesday as the big-cap tech stocks recovered from a two-day sell-off. Our registered investment advisor, Michael Shedlock. Mish, are we out of the water yet? I don't think so.
George, I don't think so either. And this Pfizer story is kind of interesting. Sold millions and millions of dollars of stock, the CEO, on the day they do this announcement. Now, they can say that this was all planned, and I believe it was because they announced these things. However, you know, when it comes to choosing a day in which he's going to make this vaccine announcement, did that just happen to be on the same day that he planned to sell? It looks kind of funny to me. I don't think they can get anything on him, but the average person is going to look at this and shake their head. One of the things I'm worried about here, George, is, I mean, the unemployment rate's been going down. That's a great thing, but there's still...
Yeah, so far, but they're going to go back to shutdowns again.
Yeah, there's 11 million people. Listen to this stat. 11 million people still unemployed. A third of them, George, 32.5%, have been unemployed for 27 weeks or longer. Guess which way that's going to go? And we've got new waves, more shutdowns coming. And then on the vaccine issue again, so they're hoping this thing's going to be successful. I don't know if you covered this story before or not, but Denmark's going to kill 17 million mink after a COVID mutation has been found. This thing went from humans to mink back to humans. George, is a vaccine going to be successful with this kind of mutations? I don't know.
I got to tell you, Bish, I'm not going to take it. I'm going to stick with my zinc, vitamin D, C, and that's just what I want. If you want to take it, that's up to you. President Donald Trump's campaign took another step in its legal strategy to upend its U.S. election loss by filing a lawsuit now in Michigan, while Georgia has announced a recount. And President-elect Joe Biden focused on laying the foundation of his incoming administration. We'll keep our eyes on that story. NASA's first SpaceX operational Crew Dragon mission set for launch on Saturday. The mission will bring NASA astronauts and a Japanese aerospace astronaut up to the International Space Station. It follows a successful Demo 2 mission earlier this year. Up next, in Peru, there are skulls that are reportedly 700 years old. Now, some people say, well, that's very human-like because they elongated the skulls. Well, wait till you have to hear from L.A. Marzulli in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, noted filmmaker, author, lecturer, L.A. Marzulli back with us. He has penned many books, including the Nephilim Trilogy, and received honorary doctorate for the series from the Pacific International University. He has subject lectured on UFOs, the Nephilim, and we're talking tonight about elongated skulls that are all over the place, primarily in Peru. L.A., where are you these days? It's hard to keep track of you.
I'm actually in North Carolina. We did a shoot at Sid Ross, Decoding the Supernatural, today. Did four programs there. And I head back to Oklahoma tomorrow, late in the day. And then Monday, I'm out to California again to work on the rebuild.
How is the rebuild coming out there? You lost everything in the California fires, of course.
We actually have a building on the property. It's the studio. the fire department is kind of holding us up. They want to know where the tanks are going to go and all this other stuff for the water tanks. But we're moving ahead and hope to break ground on the main house sometime in January.
Good. Well,
thanks for asking.
Best to you and your family, my friend. If we can help you any way we can, you let us know, too.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Now, let's take the position just for a moment that these elongated skulls in Peru that we're going to talk about are 700 years old and were elongated naturally by the indigenous people of the time. These things look weird. Folks, if you haven't seen these skulls, you got to look at them. L.A. Marzulli's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. They are like alien-looking heads. They're huge. If this is natural, L.A., one, how did they do it? Were they little babies and they pulled them? What happened?
Well, what's really interesting, there's only, you know, mainstream archaeologists basically tell us that all these skulls were the result of cranial deformation, cradle headboarding. And that essentially is when you take a small child, basically an infant, and you bind the head. You put planks of wood or bark or hard material, and you wrap the head. And
jeez.
You can do that. And we're not disputing that.
Isn't that inhumane?
Well, absolutely. It's like Chinese foot binding, the same type of deal.
Right.
We actually went to Vancouver, Mondo Gonzalez and myself, and we had an artifact that was there that was presented to this woman by her, you know, by some tribe, local tribe of Native Americans up there. And it was presented to her grandfather. Well, she winds up with this thing, and we looked at it, and it was definitely elongated. But here's the deal. You could tell it was artificially elongated. You could tell that there was cranial deformation, that someone had bound the head of that individual when that individual was a child. The question is why they're doing it. I first saw this back in 2013. Someone sent me a video. Brian Forrester was down in Senior Juan's Paracas History Museum, Paracas, Peru. We looked at this thing on YouTube. I contacted Brian, and we mounted our first expedition to go down and examine the skulls. And, of course, the reason why we did it was, you know, what am I looking at here? What is this? Is this really cranial deformation, cradle headboarding? Is this, you know, something done by humans, or is it genetic? And after 7 years, and I'm not going to tell you the punchline now, but I'm pretty much entrenched in my belief at this point.
And I have a feeling I know what that belief is, and and we will get into it for sure. Now, if they elongated the skulls of these babies 700 years ago, and that's what the mainstream scientists are wanting you to believe, what was the purpose? Was it a religious thing? What was it?
Again, all this is conjecture. And by the way, the date is actually the Paracas people show up on Paracas, Peru, about 3,500 years ago, 3,500 years ago. The 700-year-old figure that you might be coming is one of the skulls that we actually carbon dated.
Okay.
That came to be around 800 years old, 700 years old, 800 years old, right around in that frame. But here's the deal. In my opinion, they're emulating something. And cranial deformation not only happens in the Americas, it happens pretty much globally. So what are they doing? Why are these people get up on a Monday morning? What are they trying to emulate here? Why are they elongating the skull? Why is this deemed something of great importance? And we know that, you know, you go back and start looking at Egyptian artifacts with Tutankhamun and others, there's elongated skulls there. And the question is, was that artificial or was that something that's genetic?
And quite frankly, they look like praying mantis skulls, don't they?
They're very bizarre looking. There's definitely anomalies in them. And the more I got into this, this is 7 years ago, 2013, and it's been a long haul and quite the quest to get to this point. And we assembled a team of archaeologists, anthropologists, a whole bevy of doctors from all different studies, surgeons, optometrists, chiropractors, and we had all these people look at it, and it's in the film. I mean, this is number six, it's On the Trail of the Nephilim, DNA, the Final Results. And, you know, you can stream that. Go to our streaming.lamarzulli.net and check that out. The bottom line is all these people come on the record in the film, and we discuss it. They look at these artifacts. These are professionals. These are medical professionals. We have, you know, Mondo's our archaeologist. Rick Woodward is our both an archaeologist and an anthropologist. And it was Rick who discovered something very anomalous in the skull, which we really get into in the film and show why this is different, why what we're looking at, in our opinion, is something that is genetic.
Now, how many skulls are they finding all over the place?
Well, in Peru, there's still quite a few of them. I mean, last time I was out in the Chongos necropolis with Tim Alberino, we didn't see a lot of stuff, but they're there. I mean, the more of this has come out, the Huacaros, the grave robbers come in, a lot of this stuff is being sold in the black market. We know that for a fact, that European collectors are taking these things. You know, why the great interest in that? I have some theories, you know, some conjecture on that. Very interesting. But they are being sold in the black market, of course, illegally. Everything we did, as far as the DNA, it took 3 years to actually get the proper permits, to actually get permission to go down and collect the DNA. We can get into that if you want to. But what we discovered there was amazing. But that was only the tip of the iceberg. Then we started getting into the morphological, the structural differences of these enigmatic elongated skulls found in Peru and other places also.
Well, let's talk about the DNA since you brought it up, L.A. How many samples did you get? What kind of labs tested them, and what were the results?
Okay, it took basically 3 years. And thanks to Mondo Gonzalez, our team's head archaeologist, he was able to create the proper paperwork, and it's laborious. I mean, it's not something like you fill out this little, you know, one-page questionnaire and poof, you get a permit. It took 3 years to get that permit. And other archaeologists we had hired literally to do that failed. But Mondo pushed it through, got it through. We went down there with a team, the late Richard Shaw, the director of the Watchers series, filmed the entire proceedings. Chase Klautsky was our she tagged and bagged all the samples, and of course Mondo and I did all the extractions. We had all the lab gear from the Paleo DNA lab, which we had in another suitcase. We had basically 30 different changes, actually more than that, more like 50 changes of lab suits, including mask and headgear, foot gear, double gloves, double sleeves, the whole nine yards. We were covered from head to toe. We had compressed air. So when we went in and we took DNA samples from one skull, we went out of the room, changed out of one lab suit, put on a new lab suit, blew each other off with the compressed air, then went back in and took fresh samples from there. Chase Klautsky tagged and bagged everything. We had nine skulls, which we took samples from the ICA, I-C-A Museum, the ICA Museum, nine skulls from the Paracas History Museum, Senior Juan's Paracas History Museum. And out of that, we collected 58 samples, and we sent them to different labs. The only lab I'm legally allowed to mention is Paleo DNA, because I gave my word to the other two that I would not. But the other two are reputable labs in America. George, I got to tell you, we're at the point where they won't touch us anymore. We've got other samples left over from our initial collection, which the Paleo DNA lab in Canada had stored for us. And we were all excited. We were trying to find another lab to maybe extract nuclear DNA from. And the moment they find out it's L.A. Marzulli or they're Peruvian mummies, they back off completely. This is discrimination. You know, all we're conducting the scientific method here. We have a hypothesis that these entities might not be cranial deformed or cradle headboarded, that they may have migrated from the Middle East and Europe, that they may in fact be remnants of what the biblical narrative would call the Nephilim. That's our hypothesis. So we're trying to prove that using the scientific method. And the DNA results out of the 58 samples, 28 of them sequenced. Now, before I get into you, or before I get into this and tell you what we discovered, we took my DNA sample, Mondo's DNA sample, to make sure that we weren't contaminating anything.
Okay.
One of the samples was thrown out because it was contaminated. The other ones were not. We were never able to get nuclear DNA. If we had actually contaminated the samples, we would have been able to get nuclear DNA because our DNA would be very fresh and it would have completely skewed the results. That's not what happened. The protocols we instituted in the extraction were actually people who saw the film and are in that type of field said, wow, you guys really went overboard. We said, yeah, we know we did, because we know that people are going to say it's contaminated. That's the fallback position. When they don't like the results, it's a fallback position. So out of the 28 skulls, or out of the 58 samples, I should say 28 of them sequenced. And out of the 28, not every single one of them pointed to a Middle Eastern or European connection but many of them did.
Hold on right there, L.A. We'll pick up what the DNA sample showed when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take your calls next hour with L.A. Marzulli as we talk about these elongated skulls. He's just about ready to get into the DNA results when we get back with him. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with L.A. Marzulli. We're talking about elongated skulls in Peru that some say could be normal and natural humans, that they elongated as babies. Others maybe not. So 58 DNA samples, L.A. Tell us what happened.
Well, out of the 58, 28 of them basically sequenced. And many of them, or I should say some of them, would be the results exactly what we would expect. They were B. Now, the haplogroups, it comes from the mitochondrial DNA, the mother's side of the equation. And so there are lots of different haplogroups, and those haplogroups will point to a certain area of the world in which these people originated in. So when you get B, that's Amerindian. That's basically what you would expect to find in the native population of Peru or in North America.
Okay.
This is where it goes off the rails, George, that out of the 28 samples that sequenced, many of them, a good many of them, showed a Middle Eastern, Eastern European, H21E, specifically that was from this 1,935-year-old baby mummy skull, which we were allowed to unwrap and get DNA samples in Senior Juan's Paracas History Museum. That was tested at two different labs, three different times, U2E1. That is Eastern European. That rewrites history as we know it. Now, of course, the naysayers, oh, it's contamination, it's contamination. And my retort to that is, how many samples do we have to take before someone goes, well, maybe it's not contamination. Maybe people migrated here from the Middle East. And, of course, that jibes with our hypothesis, again, scientific method, which was 3,500 years ago, 3,500 years ago, when Joshua and Caleb pressed the conquest of the Promised Land. They were these tribes of hybrid entities known as the Nephilim, the Anakim, the Emim, the Zamzumim, the Horites. They were all there in the land. And what we think, this is conjecture, this is our hypothesis, when they began to go in and press this conquest, many of these tribes just packed up and fled. They just fled the area. And what we see, in my opinion, and this, of course, is in other films, is that there's traces of this. They moved west out through the Mediterranean, Cyprus, Sardinia, Sicily, Spain, Menga, into Portugal, up into the UK, and finally over here. And we show that in episode 4 and 5, America, Stonehenge, where there's a definite connection to basically the Phoenicians, once again. And the Phoenicians are a Canaanites. The Canaanites is a broad term for the Nephilim. So they're everywhere. It was utterly global. And we think they landed in Peru 3,500 years ago. And we have some startling information, which we did not put into the film. But I'll tell you basically, you know, as the interview unfolds a little bit.
Why did you get blacklisted by these DNA labs?
And if anyone's listening and they can get us into a DNA lab, please let me know. LA@LAMarzulli.net. We were given, and I'm not going to embarrass any of the labs. These are two very well-known labs in the United States. I'll just leave it at that. But they didn't like the results. They didn't like the results.
What do you mean they didn't like the results? The results are the results, right?
Well, that's what science would say. But just like my discovery out on Catalina Island when I found that photograph showing Ralph Glidden, 1919, primitive archaeologist employed by the Hay Museum, later gobbled up by the Smithsonian, front page of the L.A. Times when he actually discovered this stuff. I was on the island. I found the photograph, Glidden standing in front of a 9-footer. We had that photograph analyzed by 3 separate techs, all placed at just around 9 feet. Well, the museum redacted the photograph, redacted the giant out of the photograph. And you know, until I discovered the photograph, it was just sitting in a museum archive box in a vault. And when I published it, it went viral. And the museum didn't like the results, and so they redacted the giant. They cut it out of the picture and blew up the photograph and wrote this hit piece on Ralph Glidden. Well, we photographed that, filmed that. That went viral. And, of course, now when you go to the museum, last time I was there, the photograph is there, but there's nothing about what you're looking at, folks, is a nine-footer. And that's, again, that ties right into our whole idea of that the Nephilim were here in the Americas thousands of years ago.
Okay, and biblically speaking, the Nephilim were the offspring of human women and extraterrestrials that came here and bred with them. Now, if you believe that biblical story, does that tell you then that these elongated skulls, would you believe to be part of the offspring of the Nephilim, are humans with the Nephilim genetics born here, or did they also come from another planetary system?
Well, I don't think they're planetary, and you know where I stand on this. I think they're interdimensional. Basically,
right.
The Hebrew word is the B'nai Ha-Elohim, which refers to messengers, the angelic hosts of another dimension. So these entities came down, and we've got, you know, other books like the Book of Enoch, like the Book of Jasher, Book of Jubilees, that are not part of the biblical canon, which talk about this incursion of these entities which come down and mate with the human women. Sitchin and that whole crowd, you know, the Anunnaki, we're talking about the same thing here, in my opinion. So if you want to say it from another planet, you can say that. In my opinion, they're interdimensional. They're coming down, but they're doing the unthinkable. They're creating a hybrid entity known as the Nephilim. And this is heavily documented throughout the biblical narrative. And what's interesting, when you actually go to the Genesis 3:15 narrative, where it talks about the offspring of the dragon, the offspring of the serpent, will be at war, at enmity, with the offspring of the woman. He, the Messiah, will come and crush the dragon's head, which we know happens at Calvary 2,000 years ago. So, you know, people can choose to believe that or not. That's a prophecy that's thousands of years old, and yet we see it fulfilled basically 2,000 years ago. And then the whole thing changes, George. The whole dynamic of the Nephilim and hybrids change, and I'm going to leapfrog here into the modern UFO phenomena, but that's where it goes to. It goes to the hybrids. The same type of thing is going on, but they're not given in marriage, which fulfills another prophecy, which talks about in those days, what days? The days where men will run to and fro over the face of the earth and knowledge will increase. In those days, they, who is the they? They will mingle their seed with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave to them. And the word cleave is the same word given in marriage. There's no marriage contract like there was back in the Genesis account, the time of Noah and also afterwards when Joshua and Caleb are pushing that conquest into Canaan. I mean, it's all right there, and it's like it's very enigmatic and it's very mysterious, but a careful student of the biblical narrative can sort it out. It's not completely cloaked, and I think we've done that.
Why don't we have elongated skull people running around the planet right now?
Because they seem to have vanished, at least most of them. Now, the Kandahar giant, that, in my opinion, was a Nephilim. And we talked about that in our Watchers 10 series with my good friend of a late director, Richard Shaw. We miss him very much. But, you know, Rick and I did that film, and that went viral with the whole Kandahar giant. And hats off to Steve Quayle. Hats off to you for coming in on that and talking about it. It was just a wonderful interview. Our roles were reversed for that, but it was great.
Yeah.
And we broke that story with the Kandahar giant, which was different than Steve Quayle's account. There's, in other words, there's two giants, and the one in Kandahar was about 12 feet, lived in a cave, and we don't know how extensive that cave complex was, nor do we know how old this entity, this giant, may have been. It could have been thousands of years old. We don't know. But the whole idea of a Nephilim just sort of go away. And that's why we're not seeing this down in Peru. Now, in our film, DNA, The Final Results, we show a man from the Mubeto tribe who has an artificially elongated skull. But there are morphological differences between the elongated skulls in Paracas and this man living in present day from the Mubeto tribe. I mean, there's definite, you can see the difference. And just some of these differences, and this is why we truly believe when we state it in the film over and over again, these are genetic anomalies. They are not the result of cranial deformation. They're not. And, George, I got to tell you, I mean, I am after doing this for 7 years and looking at all the evidence and talking to medical doctors and surgeons and optometrists, this, you can't do this through pressure. You can't do this from cranial deformation, cradle head boarding. This is something that is genetic, and we can talk about some of those differences.
Now, you talked to an optometrist on the film. Tell us about his remarkable discussion.
Well, he's looking at these, and we knew something was up with the orbits, you know, where the eyeball is. We knew something was going on with that. But here's an optometrist. This guy's trained, and he's looking at, and we had more than one artifact to show him. And he's going, well, here's the first thing, that these orbits, these eye sockets, are about 30% larger than a normal human being. George, you can't do that through pressure.
No. You'll go blind. You'll blind the poor baby.
Exactly. You cannot do it. So it's 30% larger. But here's the one thing, and this is Dr. Jeff Dunn who came up with this. He's measuring the pupillary distance. They call it the PD, the pupillary distance, the distance between the pupils when they're in the eye sockets. A normal human being is between 62 millimeters and 65 millimeters. Guess what? Not only is the Parrakis elongated skulls, the orbits are 30% larger, but the pupillary distance is about 40 to 42 millimeters, completely different. And what this means, what this translates, is that more than likely they were either nocturnal, lived in caves, lived underground. And when I was with Tim Alberino last May, 2019, and we were down in Parrakis, we went out to this place. It's called a reserve. And we were there with a Peruvian archaeologist, and he took us to the remnants of the Parrakis people. Some of these things still are there. Many of them were bulldozed down and completely destroyed, but there's several of them that are still sort of intact, and they're made of whalebone with sealskin on top of it, and on top of that, like a foot or two of mollusk shells, and then they go down into the earth. And I asked the archaeologist, I said, well, you know, when you guys went down and explored these things, did you find evidence of torchlight? How could they see? And he looked at me and said, no, there was no evidence of any of that. We don't know how they saw. And so when Jeff Dunn, and you know, they could have done this too. Why they didn't do it, I don't understand it for the life of me. But in some ways, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but in some things, nobody cares and that nothing ever happens. And so, you know, it took me to bring a remnant of the skull or a model of a skull created by Joe Taylor to an optometrist here in the States. And right away he went, wow, the orbits are 30% larger, pupillary distance completely different. They were nocturnal. Here's the kicker, George. Guess what? One of the Nephilim tribes were called the Horites. The Horites. And they were cave dwellers. The word Horite means cave dwellers. We also know that because of the foramen magnum, the placement of the foramen magnum, that's that hole in the back of the skull where your spinal column attaches, okay? And we know that that's pushed back. And you've got a picture on the coast-to-coast site which shows the what's called the Chongo skull. It's the one that most people see when they go on the Internet and they type up elongated skulls. That will come up. It went viral. It's very elongated. And we were the only team up till recently who was able to take that skull out of the display case and have it turned over so we could see where the foramen magnum is. And in the film, we show this. And it's the first time that anyone's seen this, as far as I know. That foramen magnum, if it's any further back to the posterior of the skull, it's outside the skull. You cannot do that with pressure. And right. You can hear me go, when she turns it over, I go, oh, my gosh, it's all the way in the back. Because we knew what to look for because of the work of our anthropologist, Rick Woodward, who basically said the foramen, and other doctors corroborated his work, and surgeons, that the foramen magnum should be, you know, in this location, more in the center of the skull. But because it's placed all the way in the back, it would necessitate some sort of correction or an elongated neck. And here's, again, one of the Nephilim tribes, and I'm not making this stuff up, is called the Anakim. And Anakim is translated long necks. They're not giants.
Wow.
But neither are the Parrakis.
That also sounds like Anunnaki, doesn't it?
Exactly, very much. And that's why there's a similarity there. I think the mythos that we read, you know, from Zechariah Sitchin's work and others, I think it mirrors the biblical narrative. So what are we really looking at here? Are they planetary or are they interdimensional? And we don't know. If we're intellectually honest,
well, did any of the DNA samples show something unknown?
This is the deal. And if we've got listeners out there who can get us into a new high-powered DNA lab, we've got samples. We've never been able to get nuclear DNA. Now, there was a gentleman, I won't mention his name, who was privately had an incredible computer system. And we gave him one of the samples of the baby mummy skull. And he showed me where the sequencing was off in certain areas. He said, look at the sequence here, look at the sequence here. It's not human. And so, I mean,
wow.
I will state on the record here, and I will defend my position after 7 years of research, and I want to thank the donors who made much of this possible, who donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to get us down to Peru. And I didn't take a salary, from any of this. This was strictly all for research and to pay the people on our team to come down and do this research. And, of course, you know, DNA lab and testing is expensive. I just want to thank our donors to make that possible. But I stand on what we discovered, and I truly believe that these are not human beings. They are another species. Because we don't have a nuclear DNA, we're not sure what we're looking at. We don't know. We have no idea. But the fact that the mitochondrial DNA points to a Middle Eastern / European origin does rewrite history. So if you're a skeptic and you say, well, that really doesn't rewrite history, well, excuse me, with all due respect, it does. Because we're told that there was no intermingling till Columbus came over here in 1492. And we know that that's bogus. They were here on the shores of Peru, George, 3,500 years ago. As we show in our film, America Stonehenge, which is episode 4 and 5, we show that there's a stone there that says to bow of the Canaanites in dedication. And the Canaanites are a Nephilim tribe, once again, from Beirut. The whole Middle Eastern thing, Nephilim, that's a Nephilim site right here.
They're my ancestors, Lauren.
There you go. There you go.
Is it conceivable, L.A., that those DNA samples that just showed elongated skulls, and there was a portion of that, is it conceivable they were trying to emulate what they were seeing? And that would be beings with elongated skulls.
Well, I hear what you're saying. I think that these are the offspring. I mean, I really, you know, I'm going to go with Nephilim. I'm going to go with the Anakim or the Horites.
All of them.
Not all of the elongated skulls. Some of them are cranial deformed. Some of them are headbound, and we've learned.
Right, but what I'm saying is, those that were headbound, maybe they were trying to emulate the entities they were looking at.
Exactly, that's exactly the position I hold to. That's exactly what I think was going on.
That's dramatic. L.A., how do people again get a hold of you?
Well, if you want to rent the series, you can go to streaming.lamarzulli.net. Streaming.lamarzulli.net. All six films are right there. You can instant download, instant gratification, binge watch them. If you want the hard copies, you got to go to the website, lamarzulli.net. But it's mind-blowing stuff. It's real research. It's not, you know, it's not hyperbole in any way, shape, or form. This is a multidisciplined team of people who come on the record in episode 6, DNA, the final results. And it blew my mind, when we got all these guys together. And I think we're looking at a genetic anomaly, a new species.
It's an amazing story, so let's come back and take phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.